are joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A UN report concludes Pakistani authorities failed in their investigation of the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. As Poland plans a Sunday state funeral for President Lech Kaczynski and other officials in a plane who were killed in a plane crash, a dispute heats up over the burial site. Britain holds its first ever televised campaign debate, and more on that volcano hampering air travel around the world. Joining us in the studio, David Wood of PoliticsDaily.com, Elise Labatt of CNN, and Martin Walker of United Press International. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good to have you.
Good morning,
Diane. Martin Walker, talk about this UN report on the death of Benazir Bhutto.
Well, it's very critical indeed of the Pakistani authorities over the inquiry into the assassination that took place in December 2007. It particularly blames the police on the grounds that they conducted a very botched investigation. They sluiced down the murder site within an hour or so of the bombing. It's very critical of the blockages they claim they got from Pakistani authorities, particularly the intelligence services. But it is being hailed by some, at least in Bhutto's own party, for clearing up some of the more bizarre conspiracy theories that have gone around, and particularly whether the role of Musharraf or his allies. And it does, I think, tend to rather sharpen the suspicion that some of the intelligence people close to Musharraf knew a great deal more about this assassination than appeared at the time.
Of course, Elise, she knew she was going into a non-securitized zone. Wolf Blitzer last night mentioned to me that he had talked with Benazir Bhutto and then she sent him an email that she wanted him to have. What was it?
Well, she sent a private email to Wolf that in the event of her death, she wanted to know that she believed that Musharraf would be responsible. She knew that there were many threats out against her. It was no secret. And in fact, this report said that the Musharraf government really did little to provide her the kind of security she needed commensurate with these threats, and didn't even provide her the same kind of security that was afforded other former prime ministers. So it's not like anybody didn't know that she was going into this insecure environment and didn't have the security that she needed. She really foreshadowed her own death.
And David Wood, it's still a question as to why, knowing that there was no security, she decided to get up and make herself public in this zone.
Yeah, it's interesting, Diane, that this UN report it wasn't really a criminal investigation. They've passed that off now to the government of Benazir Bhutto's widower, President Zardari, who presides over a rather weak government, and it's the UN urged him to undertake a real serious criminal investigation, which, of course, will put him directly at loggerheads with Pakistan's intelligence services, who were accused by the UN of hampering the first investigation.
So, in other words, you're saying they put it in the hands of her widower. Does that mean they're exonerating her widower of having any complicity whatsoever?
I don't think they're exonerating him. It's more like they're saying, okay, you carry it from here, if you dare.
It's a bit more complex than that, I think. I had dinner with Benazir shortly before she went back, and what she was saying over dinner then was that she felt that she could rely rather more upon her own party and own supporters to provide security than she could upon the Pakistani authorities. Now, this assassination took place in Rawalpindi, which is the headquarters of the Pakistani military, and it was Benazir's people insisted that they would take care of the bulk of the security, and which has always been one of the queries, one of the question marks over this whole business. I think that the initial suspicion that was being cast by Musharraf's people upon her own widower has now been somewhat abated. But the question mark over Musharraf and his allies, I think, is still very large.
And just to put a postscript on that, an aide to Musharraf said today that a UN report on the assassination of Benazir Bhutto is a pack of lies that wrongly implicates President Pervez Musharraf and Pakistan's security forces. All right, let's turn to a volcano which has totally disrupted world travel. David Wood.
It's so interesting, Diane, to see here we had a week that was full of machinations about China's floating currency rate or non-floating currency rate and nuclear terrorism summit and all this stuff going on. But what really stopped the world was a volcano eruption in Iceland, which sent this huge plume of not just smoke, but tiny particles of glass and rock over Europe and completely shut down, properly so, shut down air travel. You can't fly an engine, airplane, through that kind of stuff without damaging the engines.
Eurocontrol, the European Air Traffic Agency, said the disruptions are even worse today, with about 11,000 flights expected to operate in Europe instead of the usual 28,000. It says delays will continue well into Saturday as the massive yet invisible ash cloud move slowly south and east.
And, I mean, this is just as the airlines are coming out of a recession, and you have these 28,000 flights a day, and now there's only going to be about 11. And it kind of lets you know that Mother Nature, when in the least opportune time, never fails to show you who's boss. And now we have the funeral of the Polish president this Sunday. We have world leaders, President Obama, Russian President Medvedev, coming in, and there is a lot of concern about the airspace in Poland and the surrounding countries. Right now, the Poles are hoping that this will clear up by Sunday.
Any question about President Obama attending the funeral?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if it remains a closed European airspace, they might have to postpone the funeral. But this thing could go on for some time. The last time this volcano erupted or gave this kind of big burp was in 1821, and it lasted for a year. And moreover, it was the precursor to an even bigger eruption by a neighboring Kalka volcano. So this could last rather longer than we fear. My guess is that they will try to hold the funeral in time if the cloud disperses. But if we get a second burp of this, we could be in for a very, very difficult summer for transatlantic travel.
And one other element on this funeral, why is there now this question as to where the president and his wife and the others are going to be buried, David?
It's very strange, Diane. I was really interested to see that the protests against the burial arrangements came mostly from young people. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting, but basically the issue is that the Catholic Church invited them to hold the funeral and the burial in the cathedral in Krakow. Which happens to be where all of Poland's great national heroes and kings are buried. And the feeling of a lot of young people was the president was a good president. It's tragic that he was killed in a car crash, but doesn't quite measure up to.
Well,
actually, he was a very divisive leader and very controversial. And you have 40,000 people, as David rightly said, a lot of them are young people. But there's a campaign of 40,000 signatures on Facebook against this. He was considered to be anti-gay rights. to have a lot of witch hunts against former communists in the media and in other civic organizations. And a lot of people feel that this is not the kind of person that should be buried in a cathedral with kings and poets and Poland's great icons.
Well, this is absolutely right. And he was very much a part of a very pro-Catholic but very conservative Catholic movement in Poland, which I think is why he was invited, or why his family was given the opportunity to bury him in the Wawel Cathedral in Krakow. But for an awful lot of young people, it's not just a matter of the kings of Poland being buried there. We've seen the reburial there of people like Sikorski, the World War II hero of Free Poland, Pilsudski, the first president of Free Poland in the 1920s. And so this is seen by many Poles as the very embodiment of the Polish national tradition.
And, of course, the Poles are left with how soon a new president is going to be elected, who that might be, where is that new president coming from in the hierarchy.
Yeah, it's going to be a tumultuous election season, as Martin and Elise pointed out. There's a lot of political currents running through Poland. There's a lot of resentment against the current government. They set elections for June 20th. That's not very far away. It's going to be pretty
well. I think there's not a lot of. I mean, there's not a lot of doubt that the party of the civic party of Prime Minister Tusk is likely now to win. The presidency is not a very powerful political post, although there's been some argument about foreign policy, and it looks as though the current acting president is going to win this one in a walk.
But what about the twin brother? The president who just died.
Well, these twins were known as by many of the neighbors, particularly the Germans, who didn't like them at all, as the potatoes, partly for their rather rustic way of speaking, but also for their rather antiquated political and nationalist ideas. And I don't think that even the sympathy vote will help one of the remaining Kaczynski twin to regain power.
Martin Walker of United Press International. Short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup this week with Martin Walker of UPI, Elise Labbitt, she's Senior State Department Producer for CNN, and David Wood, he's National Security Correspondent for PoliticsDaily.com. I look forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. David Wood, let's talk about Afghanistan. U.S. troops have left the Korangal Valley. Now, was that planned?
No, Diane, it wasn't planned. And there's been a lot of criticism of this move as the U.S. is actually abandoning part of Afghanistan. But I think the real meaning here is that the U.S. is now refocusing on who is the enemy. The people who lived in the Korangal Valley are not part of the whole Taliban movement, although they allied themselves with it. They're ethnically and linguistically different from other people who live in Afghanistan. They're very intensely xenophobic. They hate any foreigners who come into their area. And this is a tiny little piece of Afghanistan. It's 6 miles long and a very, you know, one of those very deep valleys. I was with a Marine unit that was going on an operation. We were going to drop in on a helicopter raid. And just literally as we were getting on the helicopters, I asked the Marine intelligence officer, who is the enemy? And he said, well, it's whoever's shooting at us. And to a large extent, that's been the central U.S. strategy in Afghanistan for years, and clearly it's not working. So now what's happening is the U.S. is sharpening its focus on who is the enemy, and the enemy is the Pashtuns. And that's where you're going to see a really refocused campaign against the Pashtuns.
Well, hang on a second. I mean, the elected President Karzai is a Pashtun. I mean, two-thirds of the population, or 60% of the population, are Pashtun. I think the enemy is the Taliban rather than the Pashtun as a whole, is it not?
Well, yes, but where the forces are gathering and where the strategic focus is going to be is on southern Afghanistan and Kandahar and Helmand provinces, and that's dominated by the Pashtun Taliban. Well, and it's not politically nice to pose this as a war against Pashtuns, but I think that's how it's going to work
out. It's also, you know, kind of refocusing an effort by General McChrystal to consolidate and refocus forces where you can gain the momentum in the cities and the towns where they can protect the population. This was considered, this Korangal province was called the Valley of Death. There were never enough soldiers. It was one of the places where they hardly ever won a battle. 42 Americans died, hundreds wounded, and in the end, it was really considered a waste of time. They were not making momentum there, and then now this is an effort to go, as we've seen, in Kandahar, in these other areas, and where we've seen that, you know, they can make some momentum where they have these government kind of moving in after, building up, you know, Korangal province. In the end of the day, to General McChrystal, it was unfortunate, but it was really a waste of time for
and
the United States.
Both Major General Flynn and President Obama said yesterday, time is running out. Martin.
Well, indeed, and President Obama said that he still wants to start the withdrawals next year. What's also interesting is that General Flynn had earlier sounded quite optimistic, whereas he'd previously given some very dire warnings about the level of intelligence and so on. I think the most reasonable statement of all was the one made by General Petraeus when he said that it makes no sense to be optimistic nor to be pessimistic. One's just got to be realistic about the scale of the challenge of being faced.
Actually, General Flynn in December gave the most damning assessment that anybody had seen, saying that time is running out, the insurgency can sustain itself indefinitely, and now he actually seems to be softening a little bit. There were some kind of nebulous reports that he's starting to say that, you know, peace is close, that, you know, the Afghans really need to stand up and take the lead here. And he sees a little bit more optimism. We're not really quite clear. He's kind of been talking to these little known think tanks and dribbling out. But he really did anger the military and intelligence agencies when he gave this report in December saying that the military intelligence was bad, that U.S. and international forces didn't have much intelligence on the battlefield. And now he seems to be shifting responsibility to the Afghans, and they have to take the lead. They have to stand up now.
Well, he was proved right, because a month after he said that, we had this terrible incident of the 6 CIA people being killed.
And there was a suicide bombing in Kandahar just this week as well.
Well, two car bombs, and this is right before the NATO and U.S. operation in Kandahar kind of gears into full force over the summer. And the Taliban is certainly trying to send a message that it's going to be a long haul if you consider that you're coming into Kandahar with these forces and the Afghan government.
Yeah, and sort of reinforcing that, the U.S. military sees a long haul there, too. This fall, they're going to be moving an entirely new division command into Kandahar. They're splitting southern Afghanistan into two separate commands. One, the Marines will be in Helmand province, and the 10th Mountain Division will be in Kandahar. It's a huge doubling down on that effort, which is why I think that they're really going to go after the Pashtun Taliban.
Well, I mean, good luck. I do think that the Afghanistanis themselves, the Afghans themselves, and the Pashtun and the Taliban have got a great deal more resilience than we tend to think. And I think if we do, if President Obama is right and the drawdown of troops begins next year, I think that we will see the Taliban increasingly become part of Afghan government thereafter.
All right, let's turn our attention to the first ever televised debate in Britain last night. What happened, Martin Walker?
Well, the three party leaders, Prime Minister Gordon Brown, the Conservative David Cameron, who thought he was almost a shoo-in to be the next Prime Minister, and the third party's Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg, all got up and did their stuff before a crowd. And by all accounts, and certainly from what I saw when I watched it, Nick Clegg carried off the day. The instant polling suggested that 60% thought he'd won it, whereas about 18, 19, 20% thought that Brown or Cameron had won it, and those, of course, are the party faithful. Clegg was the man who had most to do in that he had to really introduce himself to the bulk of the British public. He had to establish himself. He had to suggest that they had more and different and better ideas. He did all of that. So the big question now is, does this mean that the traditional 18, 19% of the vote that the Liberal Democrats get is going to soar? Mm. And if so, that increases sharply the chances of a hung parliament. Now, a hung parliament is where no one party has enough seats to form a government or for the Queen to invite them to form a government without guaranteed support from the Liberal Democrats. So that is the conventional wisdom. The Liberal Democrats look like being kingmakers. However, I was just talking to EJ Dion before I came in here, who is, as you know, is passionate about British politics. And EJ was saying, ah, yes, but if Labour voters start to move towards voting Liberal Democrat, that could put the Tories in. So I think one thing you have to bear in mind is that the British electors are quite a savvy lot. And over the past 15, 20 years, they have been voting tactically in large numbers. Mm-hmm. And so I think they will figure this one out.
I think what's really interesting is that kind of the Americanization of British politics. You know, we don't have TV ads, TV kind of campaign ads in Britain, but now you have these debates. I mean, usually
could open the way.
And right, and Nick Clegg was kind of the Ross Perot of British politics.
Oh my God.
And he kind of, you know, he just, I mean, maybe not in his politics per se, and obviously Martin follows it more closely, but kind of saying that we need a new politics, very charismatic. And I think, you know, now the British people, they usually see kind of Gordon Brown answering to the House of Commons, and it's very structured. But now you see this on TV, the debate is longer, it's very revealing, and we're kind of seeing this Americanization of politics. Gordon Brown and David and Cameron both had used President Obama's kind of campaign strategists. And so they're really taking a page from American politics, I think.
If there was one single soundbite, which is, I think, one of the classic things of the Americans, it was Nick Clegg's, the Liberal Democrat, when he said, he turned to the other two and he said, you know, the more they attack each other, the more they sound the same.
Well, and Gordon Brown kept saying, I agree with Nick, I agree with Nick. But in the end, if he keeps saying he agrees with Nick, he might throw some votes his way.
How many more televised debates will there be?
There'll be two more.
Two more.
And we've already had an earlier one with the main economic policy makers of the three parties. It's really transforming the whole mood of the election. It's giving it some sort of artificial peaks and so on, and a great deal of new momentum. I think it's terrific.
Better,
but
the one or worse?
I think
more
in many ways it's better. And I one of the things that I was relieved about was that it was not, I mean, I take your point about the Americanization of British politics, but it was not an American-style debate. There was a huge amount of substance and figures and detail and policy. I mean, it was something that made you feel rather good about British politics.
Interesting.
For once.
David.
I was just going to say that the one thing I wanted to know in the aftermath of this debate was, did the Queen watch and what did she think?
Yeah.
And
good
darn
question.
It, the British press let me down on that.
All We're right. Not allowed to know.
Let's turn to China. China's economy grew nearly 12% last quarter. Compared to the first quarter last year, what is behind this surge, Elise?
Well, it's continuing to show exports, and the economy is very strong, and obviously China shows that it's been able to bounce back from the world recession. But at the same time, it has this trade deficit of $7.2 billion in the world, and that's the first time in 6 years. And, you know, this may kind of buttress a lot of pressure from the United States for China to revalue its currency. Ben Bernanke, President Obama, a lot of others have been saying to China, it's really time to revalue your currency. It's fueling a growing trade gap with the United States. And there was a lot of speculation that while President Hu was here, China was going to be called a currency manipulator. And they kind of postponed that decision, you know, for the sake of diplomacy. But there is a lot of pressure on China to revalue its currency.
Well, I think there's no mystery as to why China has had this surge of growth. In October of 2008, they announced a $586 billion stimulus package, which is by far the largest in proportion to their economy. But that was only about a third of what they did. By far the biggest thing that the Beijing government did was it ordered its banks to lend like never before. Hmm. And in the course of the last 13 months, Chinese banks lent $1,400 billion. As opposed to U.S. banks. But that means they were lending a third of GDP. We have never known any country in history do this before.
Well, the question is, are we going to see what we saw in the United States, in China, years from now, where China continues to lend? You have bad debts. You have
bubbles.
All these troubled assets. And I mean, China's rising a boom right now, but we've seen this in Japan and other countries. You know, years from now, China could be headed for a big fall.
Companies, state-owned enterprises who got the bulk of the money were desperate to think, what can we do with this money we're being forced to lend? So what they've been doing, they have been buying, stockpiling raw materials, commodities, particularly copper, aluminum, and so on. And that is why their imports are much higher. That is why they've got this short-term trade deficit. And it's just because they're trying to find something to do with this money they've been forced to buy.
Martin Walker of UPI, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And, of course, at the same time, Chinese are dealing on the rescue effort in western China after this devastating earthquake. Mother Nature is not happy right now. There is so much going on. David, what's the death toll so far? It's up to over 700 people.
Yeah, and, you know, you can't help but compare it to Haiti, of course, where there were many more people killed. And it calls into question the whole habit we have of measuring how bad things are by the number of hundreds or thousands of people who are being killed. It was interesting to see how quickly China responded to this earthquake, which was in a very, very remote part of western China. And boy, they were right on it. They're really good at this. But of course, you know, the suffering goes on and on and on there, as it has in Haiti.
And speaking of Haiti, the First Lady of the United States made that special trip.
That's right. She made a surprise trip this week with the Vice President's wife, Jill Biden. And she said that, you know, since the earthquake, she really wanted to go, but she didn't want to distract from the rescue effort because that would take a lot of resources. But I think what she really wanted to do was refocus attention on Haiti. You know, there was a huge media presence right after the earthquake, but once that media presence goes, you know, people don't forget, but, you know, their mind kind of wanders elsewhere.
Sure.
And so I think she really wanted to refocus attention on Haiti and have more media attention because of her visit, but also show the Haitians that the U.S. is still committed to you. We haven't forgotten about you. She met with aid workers, and she also met with a lot of children and said, in the midst of all of this, we really can't forget about the children. We need to help them. We need to empower them. And she did the same thing, really, when she visited Mexico as well. It was really, the message was, children are our future. We really need to empower them and give them all the tools so that they can be the future leaders
she
of this
world.
She
did not talk about drugs in Mexico, David.
No, she didn't talk about anything controversial.
Well, and she did say we need immigration reform.
Well, yeah, okay. Mostly it was a feel-good visit, and it was a nice kind of balance to all the hard news of the week to have Michelle posing with children and flowers and so forth. A lot of good photo ops. And I you know, it was her first solo foreign outing. She did very well, and we go on from here.
All right, and one other point here. The president of Kyrgyzstan resigned. He left the country. What happened, Elise?
Well, there's been a lot of pressure for him to step down. And at first he was saying no. He was threatening violence if he wasn't allowed to roam free. And what happened on the sidelines of the nuclear summit, President Obama, the president of Kazakhstan, Nazarbayev, and Kyrgyzstan heads the OSCE right now, and Russian President Medvedev met together. They kind of hatched out this plan for Kazakhstan to take President Bakayev, and Kazakhstan sent a plane there. And this was all because Kazakhstan is the head of the OSCE. It all has this whiff of legitimacy that Europe endorses this, the United States and Russia endorses. So they sent a plane for him. He Nazarbayev had the closest relationship with Bakayev, and now he's out. And everyone is really looking forward now towards the interim government, which is going to be the authority until elections take place. And the U.S. is signaling a lot of support for this government.
There was a bit of a hiccup when it looked like Bakayev might not actually fall in with this deal, because he'd fled from the capital of Bishkek down towards the southern area. Now, you know, Kyrgyzstan is divided down the middle by this huge mountain chain. The southern clans were, he thought they were his, but he found himself being shot at and demonstrated against it in Osh, so he said, right, I will go.
Martin Walker, he's foreign affairs writer for United Press International. Short break, your calls when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Catherine Russo. Russell has a new CD, the third under her own name. She spent years as a backup singer for performers like Paul Simon, David Bowie, and Cyndi Lauper. Her father was Louis Armstrong's music director during much of the 30s and early 40s. Join us.
And it's time to open the phones. We'll go first to Cliff in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. We were talking about the Pashtun earlier, and you know, I wonder if it strikes anybody that trying to work with people, as we have in America, with African Americans and various disparate groups, bringing democracy and the idea of democratization, rule of law, and for a person to surrender long-held traditions and beliefs, which are rich in their heritages, is almost a losing battle. Have we learned nothing from colonialism? And I'll leave you with, and I wonder if it was a follow-up to that. It strikes many people, if you read blogs on the web, that an attempt is made to go in and take advantage of each of these disasters, each of these circumstances, using disaster capitalism techniques, and the stories don't tend to follow up.
All right. Thanks for calling, David.
Cliff, two good questions. Let me take the one about Pashtuns first. It's very much a part of U.S. military strategy to try to bring ordinary Afghans into a stable relationship with the government, to bring in not just security, but then to bring in aid and development. A lot of soldiers in Afghanistan are either working to train Afghan soldiers and police or, you know, working with district managers and district councils and provincial councils on things like budgeting and, you know, to get their governance up and running. So that's very much a part of it.
Here's an email from Mike who says, I served in the Korngal Valley as recently as January 2010, and contrary to a statement by one of your guests, I can assure you that leaving the Korngal was planned over the long term. We are leaving because the people do not want us there, and the military resources can be better used elsewhere. David.
Yeah, I think that's precisely right. And thank you for your service. I know that was a tough place to serve. I think the writer is exactly right that we weren't wanted there and that it was a waste of military resources to keep trying to push that.
I think the initial justification for having some kind of U.S. military presence there was that the place was being used as a transit point for Taliban coming in from Nuristan and from the Pakistan frontier districts. And the thinking now seems to be that they will get just as rough a welcome from the locals as the American troops did.
To Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Hi. The assassination of Prime Minister or Mrs. Bhutto, I apologize for mispronouncing. If they can't protect her, which is not rocket science, how can we trust them to protect their nuclear weapons?
Good question, Elise.
Well, I mean, some might say that a lot of the security services and intel services didn't have an interest in protecting the former Prime Minister Bhutto, whereas they do have an interest in safeguarding the nuclear weapons. And although there is a concern in Pakistan, and we did see that raised this week at the nuclear summit, I think by all accounts, although there are concerns, that the general impression is that, at least for now, the nuclear arsenal in Pakistan is well guarded and safe.
How valuable was that nuclear summit this week, Martin?
Well, I think an awful lot of it was cosmetics. 47 nations, nothing, very little dramatic news. But if there was one really interesting development, it was entirely in this area about Pakistan, because the Bush administration, as you know, had offered India a special nuclear relationship, which had got the Pakistanis very worried. And now it's been suggested by the Obama administration that a certain amount of help to Pakistan's own peaceful nuclear development could come. And the Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, for the first time, did not object to this. And he said that would be a bilateral matter for the US and Pakistan, which has been greeted in Pakistan with extreme enthusiasm. And so we might just have some kind of thaw taking place between these two nuclear powers in South Asia.
Well, you're not going to see the kind of deal that we saw with the US and India,
no.
Although they could help out Pakistan. But I'm kind of a mixed view on the usefulness of the nuclear summit. I mean, in one hand, it's true. It was, you know, a large group of leaders. President Obama was able to kind of raise his foreign policy credentials and put his stamp on his own agenda on an issue that, let's face it, nuclear terrorism, who's for it? Safeguarding nuclear weapons, who's against it? But at the same time, I mean, there were some positives. And in one sense, when you have world leaders, so many world leaders committing to safeguarding their nuclear material and making sure it doesn't fall into the hands of terrorists, that's a lot of accountability there. And they're going to meet again in 2 years, and they're going to have to show what they've done. Mm. They also had a lot of little, what the White House was calling house gifts, that all of the countries would, it's kind of like the Clinton global initiatives where you come and you make a pledge. And we did have quite a few small but notable things. The Russians have committed to reduce stockpiles of plutonium. Ukraine said it would get rid of some of its high-enriched uranium from the Soviet era. Chile, Mexico. I mean, these are all little things that were in train. But this summit kind of pushed them along. And I think that, you know, there is a refocused attention to this, and that can't be bad.
Dave.
It was interesting, Diane, pardon me, that with all the trouble that Obama is going through at the moment, his popularity is down, he's being buffeted by all these political currents here at home, that he can basically snap his fingers and a whole bunch of the world's leaders show up here, and not only show up, but they've, as Elise was saying, they've got to bring something, and they're on the carpet to say what they're doing or have done or going to do. It was quite a display of power.
By the way, we have an update on the Polish funeral. Kaczynski's family has insisted they want to go forward with the funeral as planned. So far, President Barack Obama, Russian President Medvedev, and German Chancellor Merkel are among those coming. Nobody is canceled, but Merkel could not even get back to Berlin after a visit to Washington. She was diverted to Madrid and looking for a hotel room.
Well, thank goodness for the European fast train service.
Well, that's one way to look at it. To Newbury, Ohio. Good morning, Rita. You're on the air.
Good morning. This is a thought question. The Icelandic eruption caused me to think, we have all these earthquakes at the South Pole, in China, in Haiti, like all over the globe, and big earthquakes. And I'm wondering if the amount that we have extracted from beneath the surface over the centuries of oil and coal and all the other materials has disrupted our balance.
We do wonder what's going on, how to explain Mother Nature, and whether there is human involvement in all of these eruptions, earthquakes, storms.
And how much global warming has a role in it. You know, we've seen a lot of wacky weather here in Washington, but that's just a microcosm for what's happening around the world. And how much is climate change contributing to all these earthquakes and volcanic ash? It's a really good question.
It's interesting that the authorities have assured us that this recent spate of earthquakes is not caused by any man-made factor. But I get the feeling more and more that we don't really know. And what we're learning about climate change is that we didn't really know. And we're learning more and more about that and the role that humans play in it.
They're certainly coming thick and fast, but then historically they have come thick and fast before. If I were recording this program in California, I think I'd be getting nervous.
To Cleveland, Ohio, Ahmed, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, too. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
Time Bhutto was shot, she had her head outside the car. I was never a fan of Musharraf, but Musharraf said that she's really to blame for putting her head outside the car.
Well, it's a very good point, and that's what the Pakistanis, the aides to former President Musharraf, are saying, that intel agencies did warn her of the threats.
Why did they give her the security? This is a
question that we've talked about, that they didn't give her the security she needed, but she did know that these threats exist. She did have this sense, which, you know, we've all kind of interviewed her in the weeks and months before her death, and she did have a foreshadowing that she was ready to be a martyr, that she knew that there were all these threats against her, and she knew how much security she had when she went to that rally. She was advised not to go, and she did make the decision because she thought it was important, even though she knew it could kill her.
And she felt that they were her people. She wanted to say to
exactly
them, you know, I am here. Let's go to Indianapolis. Johnny, you're on the air.
Yes. My comment, I was listening to one of your commentators, and it seems like every time they get a chance to, they always say that Obama's in trouble. And an example of why I don't think he is when you look at the body language and the way the rest of the world wants to cooperate with him, you get the impression that the only place he's having problems is here in this country.
Good point, Johnny. Martin.
Yes, I mean, I think that was what was interesting was the way in which back at the beginning of the year, when things were looking a little bit more problematic and healthcare was in trouble, there did seem to be a wavering in the kind of global enthusiasm for Obama. But that has changed. And I think it might have been uncertain whether Hu Jintao, the Chinese president, would have come to the nuclear summit had healthcare not gone through. But if
that's
you add,
an interesting point, Martin.
If you add these successes that Obama has had up together, healthcare, I think the nuclear summit was a success, the disarmament deal or the arms reduction deal with the Russians was a success. I think the guy's batting pretty well.
But at the same time...
I forgot to say, and he seems to have fended off the Great Depression.
These are all, I do agree with Martin, but at the same time, he has made a lot of promises around the world. For instance, with his promise on outreach to the Muslim world, which we really haven't seen a lot of. And there are some leaders in the Middle East that are saying, you know, what about us? We're waiting for you to solve the Middle East conflict. Afghanistan is still a question. And so I think that the nuclear summit was a success. He did have this healthcare. He had a good couple of weeks. But I think the question is still out whether over the long term, President Obama is going to continue to be the kind of world statesman that he's shown himself to be this week.
But he did indicate a kind of urgency this week on dealing with the issue of the Middle East.
Yes, he very explicitly linked American security to the failure to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute.
Do you think he might take a more personal and active role?
He's clearly signaling that. Look, this guy is moving fast on a whole lot of fronts. I mean, just in the last couple of weeks, we've had all the nuclear summit, the agreement with the Russians, and so on and so forth. And this was a big step. You know, this was saying to the world, we don't just have a moral stake in this. We have a practical security stake in it.
David Wood, he's with PoliticsDaily.com. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Miami, Florida. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, and thank you. I've been wondering if Benazir Bhutto's death was actually a suicide.
A suicide? Why do you say that?
She put herself in position to be assassinated.
I really don't swallow that.
I don't think so.
I really don't swallow that at all. I think that this was a brave woman who felt that she had a particularly unique role that she could play in Pakistan, and she was prepared to accept the risks to try and do that. Bear in mind, it wasn't simply that she was fighting for an election. She was fighting to restore civilian, elected, democratic rule in Pakistan. And if that's her legacy, it's not a bad one.
All right. To John, who's here in Washington, D.C., you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you very much. I am calling regarding the meeting after the summit that was had by Congressman Adam Schiff with King Abdullah of Jordan, where King Abdullah expressively talked about the fears, the imminent invasion of southern Lebanon by Israel, and maybe issues of Israel attempting to gain territory in Syria. And I'll just listen off the air. Thank you very much.
Martin.
Yes, I mean, this is one of those things that's been bubbling around the whole of the Middle East for some time as a possible topic. And I think that the real reason for that is something we just were talking about, which is the role or the perception of Obama in the world. And bear in mind that President Obama has got the kind of pulpit and the kind of voice where he can appeal, in a sense, to public opinion over the heads of national leaders. And that seems to be happening in Israel, where we've seen some real shift in the polling about Israeli voters' attitudes towards their own settlements. The way in which Obama has signaled he's really rethinking fundamentally the relationship with Israel, I think has had quite an impact upon Israel. The very conservative government coalition that's now in charge in Israel, I think, is really very worried about this. And not only are they trying to whip up the rhetoric.
To what extent? I mean, what are you saying? That the people who are creating these new settlements are beginning to have doubts?
I think there's certainly doubts about their long-term viability. But I'm talking about the overall polling within Israel itself, which is suggesting that more and more people are saying the settlements are going to have to go.
Well, the settlements are very small but very powerful force in Israel. I think that there is a, as Martin said, a kind of broader feeling in the country that perhaps the settlements are counterproductive, and more importantly, that it's a hamper to the peace deal that everybody needs. The demographics are changing in Israel, and the Israelis are. Public is desperate for a deal, and I think there's also been a changing in the polling of opinions of Obama since he took office.
So what you're saying is Obama, his words are somehow getting to the people over the heads of people like Benjamin Netanyahu.
I'm saying exactly that I think that Israeli voters, or many of them, seem to have been really sobered by the feeling that their traditional alliance with the U.S. is at risk because of the intransigence of their government.
Martin Walker, he's foreign affairs writer for UPI. Elise Lappet, she's senior State Department producer for CNN, and David Wood, he's national security correspondent for PoliticsDaily.com. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.